From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's start the hour with the stock market. The Dow is currently up slightly after yesterday's largest ever point drop in the Dow's history, nearly 1,200 points, or about 4.6%. The S&P 500 has fallen nearly 8% since January 26th. This morning, the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, was asked about the market at a House Financial Services Committee hearing.
The stock market is up significantly, over 30% since President Trump was elected. We're monitoring the stock markets. They're functioning very well. And we continue to believe in the long-term impact of the stock market.
Earlier today, I spoke with Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary and President Emeritus of Harvard University. He joined us from Hong Kong. And I asked him, tongue firmly in cheek, if it was time to panic.
No, it's not time to panic. Panic is never a constructive response to any situation. And for the vast majority of investors who aren't professional, experience teaches that they're better off setting an overall portfolio strategy and sticking with it and not trying to change their position in response to day-to-day market developments. So panic is definitely the wrong response, but serious concern is, I think, the right response.
Why? What are you concerned about? And did all of this surprise you in the last few days?
It surprised me in the last couple of days, of course. Nobody wakes up expecting that on a given day the market's going to fall 600 or 1,000 points. On the other hand, I had the gathering sense for some time that there was excessive complacency in the market, that too many people were assuming that the market was a one-way upwards escalator.
What does it tell you that we're seeing this happen so soon after the passage of the Republican tax bill, which could be seen as a stimulus for the economy?
I think this is probably not heavily related to the Republican tax bill. I think the Republican tax bill was a mistake. I think we fired our fiscal cannon, in some sense, before we needed it, of fiscal stimulus, and that may prove to be a costly error. I think that if the economy does turn down, if the markets stay down for a long time and stay down in a major way, that will obviously increase the risk of recession. But those issues at this point are somewhat premature. The right view for people to have now is of concern and a focus on restoring adequate growth. As you know, my feeling has been for quite some time that the priority of the Fed has to be reattaining the 2% inflation target, and that rather than control to lower inflation, should be the major Fed priority.
What do you expect the new Fed Chair Jerome Powell to do, given what's going on?
I think he will want very much to stick with the scheduled March increase that the Fed has been telegraphing in its speeches for the last month or two. It could easily be that the markets will recover somewhat today and cruise their way back upwards a little bit. This will look like a very normal market fluctuation with a particularly dramatic moment. It's also possible that this will be seen as the beginning of a longer period of economic distress. So I think it's hard to make a definite judgment.
How concerned are you about inflation right now? Because we really have not seen much inflation over the past many years.
I don't think inflation is our primary concern right now. I think the slowdown of the economy is our primary concern. On the other hand, I think it is good for there to be vigilance and for there to be a sense that the policy authorities are absolutely reluctant to putting ourselves into a situation where substantial inflation would again become a possibility.
Larry Summers, you're joining us from Hong Kong. Are people as worried in Hong Kong as they watch the markets in Asia as we see in the U.S. right now?
I think there's very substantial concern, and I think the concern, frankly, is magnified by a sense that if a crisis were to come, the United States might not have quite the team in place that could deal effectively with a major crisis.
That's Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury and President Emeritus of Harvard University. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Well, to cancer treatment now. For people diagnosed with slow-growing forms of cancer and some pre-cancerous conditions, a treatment increasingly being offered by doctors is no treatment. It's called active surveillance, and it involves regular monitoring of the cancer's progress with the option to get treatment at any time. But how does a patient weigh the side effects of cancer treatment against doing nothing and maybe seeing it spread out of control? Reporter Alicare Peltonen tells how her own father came to his decision.
Bad news is sometimes like a boogeyman, standing behind you, giving you the creeps before you know he's there. Last spring, I was cutting up a pineapple, covered in juice, and I normally wouldn't have answered my phone. But seeing Dad on the screen for some reason made the hair on my arm stand up. He was calling to tell me he had cancer. It was his prostate, and they caught it early, which was good. But now my 71-year-old father, Neil Marshall, had a decision to make.
When I first listened to the doctor, it was obvious he didn't have a firm grip on the details.
But the urologist gave my dad three options: surgery, radiation, or active surveillance. My military-minded father is a man of action. To him, active surveillance seemed somehow too passive.
Yeah, it was one of those, okay, you don't have to do anything right now. Just wait until it's almost going to kill you, and then you can. I thought, geez, that doesn't sound like a smart option, you know.
But I was surprised to learn that lots of men are choosing active surveillance for low-grade prostate tumors, and many of them will never need treatment.
We have spent a large amount of effort and energy over the last 100 years to teach everyone that cancer is bad.
I spoke with Otis Brawley, Chief Medical Officer of the American Cancer Society.
Today, after a number of clinical studies, we realize that over half of all screen-detected prostate cancers, for example, can be safely watched and do not need to be treated in a man's lifetime.
But I still didn't like to think about the cancer just sitting there in my dad's body. And if I was uncomfortable, I knew my mother, Sheila, was in agony about it.
It's C-word, so, you know, they can say, hey, nobody ever has any problem with this, it's fine. But in the back of my head, it was like, yeah, but there's always that one person, you know, and this could be him.
If it were up to my mom, the tumor would have been gone yesterday. To her, any side effects from surgery or radiation were better than the prospect of losing her husband. But Michael Berry, a primary care doctor at Mass General Hospital, said many men have concerns about the side effects from treatment.
Complications of, say, prostate cancer treatment, trouble with urination, incontinence, sexual dysfunction, are things that people can imagine what it's like for them, and a spouse might kind of help talk that through and think it through.
Barry told me that family members, particularly spouses, should be a part of the decision-making process.
I think the challenge for a spouse is trying to say, I want to help by making sure what you value is being considered in the decision.
Over the next few months, my parents talked a lot about what to do. My dad, who has no problem sharing, described to me what he saw as the potential downsides of treatment.
The thing I was most concerned about is that I was going to have to walk around in diapers for the rest of my life. And the other is, what's your sexual situation going to be? Sheila, what do you think?
No, I think the sexual part of it is important to have. But it's not the end-all or be-all if you have a decent relationship to begin with. Because, you know, you start off as friends, and you hope to keep that going for the rest of your time together.
In weighing the options, it eventually seemed obvious that for my parents, anything less than treatment felt too risky.
When I went through the literature, particularly on the web, I found that active surveillance seemed to be more of a let's hide our head in the sand.
Easy way.
Yeah.
As it turned out, a closer look at the biopsy results in June showed that my dad's cancer was a little more advanced than originally diagnosed. That was enough to take active surveillance off the table. So my father had his prostate removed on August 1st. He recovered quickly, and he and my mom are coping with the side effects of surgery. When I saw them at Thanksgiving, they were still happy with their decision.
I've kind of forgotten that it was anything important, almost.
Never. It's like it never happened.
Yeah.
You know, it was like a little procedure. You had the procedure, it's done.
Yeah, just continue on with life.
And the fact that he doesn't have to worry about it again.
Ever.
Like, taken care of.
Making cancer treatment decisions is complicated. Sometimes there's one right answer and you have to act quickly. But not all cancers are boogeymen. If you have prostate cancer and active surveillance is an option, it makes sense to carefully consider whether or not you can live with the side effects of treatment. And if you're lucky enough to have a relationship like my mom and dad, you don't have to make the decision alone. For Here and Now, I'm Alicare Peltonen.
Once, not long ago, a group of musicians came from Egypt to Israel. You probably didn't hear about it. It wasn't very important. So begins The Band's Visit, the new Broadway hit about what happens over a single day when a small Egyptian police band accidentally buys bus tickets to the small, dusty Israeli desert town of Beit HaTikva with a B instead of the vibrant cultural center of Petah Tikva with a P, where they were supposed to perform. The owner of the town's tiny cafe, played by Katrina Lenk, points out their mistake.
Where you are, this is not Petah Tikva. Such a city, nobody knows it. Not a fun, not a art, not a culture. This is Petah Tikva with a B.
Katrina Lenk learned Hebrew for her part. Veteran actor Tony Shalhoub, who plays the head of the Egyptian band, remembered his father's Arabic for his. They and the cast, which includes professional Arab musicians, transport the rest of us. We sat down recently with Tony Shalhoub, Katrina Lenk, and director David Cromer during a break between shows. And I asked Tony what this show, based on an Israeli film that purports to be about a day in which nothing happened, what it's really about.
Well, that's such a gigantic question. I think at its heart, it's about hope. And another layer under that is it's about people's ability to forgive either themselves or each other as a first step.
There's a fight that ensues. You're in the middle of a fight between Katrina's character, Dina, and a lover of hers, a very quiet, dignified character that you play, but he just bursts out, "You can forgive."
Yeah, and I think it's a deep lesson that he came to in his own life and didn't take the opportunity or didn't have the understanding to forgive, and that ended very badly. He's learned that if we all could do that, we can sort of salvage our broken lives.
Well, but of course it becomes at a time when there's a much bigger picture. You have Arabs and Israelis together in a town, and some would say, well, forgiveness, that's too simple. Katrina, your thoughts on that, because the characters don't talk about politics ever.
Yeah, it's not about politics. It's about people just being people and having basic human needs, love, food, joy.
Music,
yeah. And music is a big connecting tool, I think, when you don't speak the same language.
But it's interesting that you say the music, because, David, you as a director work around both the music and the book. Mm-hmm. Never has it been more clear that people could connect through the music and then had a harder time connecting when they didn't have the music.
It's a pretty obvious way for people to talk. Now, when we talk about the politics, the thing that I always think is interesting is there's a moment anytime you confront someone who is an other to you. We might feel tension, we might be mad, but I don't immediately start saying, like, in 1967, you know what I mean? We don't really do that. So when these characters, very ordinary people in a situation, are confronted with each other, there's a little switch in everyone's head, which is I can either freeze up or just say, we don't serve your kind around here or something, or we just say, you can sit here, you can stay here for a little while. What do people talk about? We talk about food and music.
Love sparks on the upbeat, igniting with a minor nine, resolving to a major six, then something clicks and everything starts.
We're just saying it's just a way to fill the silence.
It is that very wide door that opens and everybody begins to flow in both directions.
We went to Israel. So many times as actors, you do all kinds of research and read things and imagine, and we didn't have to imagine anymore what it was like to be in this town. We could go and stand there on that sand and feel the wind and just to get a sense of a place is what a gift. And there's something similar, I think, to all small towns everywhere, the sense of, obviously, of community and tight-knitness, but also like the feeling of, oh, this is all there is there more, should I leave, should I stay? The similarities between all kinds of small towns and all kinds of people who feel stuck or people who are lost really was instantly relatable, and I think is relatable to a lot of people who come to see the show.
Tony, you do have Lebanese background, both your parents from Lebanon?
Well, my father was from Lebanon. My mother was born here, but her parents were from Lebanon. I've always had that sort of connection. But I agree that it isn't really just about the Middle East. I got a letter recently from someone, they live in Ireland, about how they related to conflicts there within their country in small towns and how people were hesitant to move into certain other areas and how beautiful this was to them and how relatable it was. My parents spoke Arabic and my grandparents did. And my grandfather, when he was a boy, he sang in the choir in Lebanon, in the church, whatever. We would go to visit them. They live near us. And he would be singing these songs in Arabic. Some were hymns, some were not. And it was beautiful and haunting and completely, for us, I grew up in Green Bay, for God's sake. And, I mean, it was sort of mesmerizing. And Yazbek music really evokes all of that.
And your hands just did what your character does as a conductor. You just were moving your hand. No, it's beautiful.
They also taught me to speak with my hands.
Well, it would mean a lot to me if, you know, just that notion of being able to sort of get in touch with your ancestor a little through this character.
Absolutely. And there's so much of this character of Tufik that seems like facets of my own father and my grandfather. He seems like an amalgam of all of these Arab men.
Very, very dignified, very straight-backed, very, in the case of this conductor that you play,
very not forthcoming, frankly, or with a sort of a reluctance or an inability to express and verbalize, you know, all of these deep feelings and emotions. I don't gravitate to the musicals, usually. I had to overcome my fear. It was an experience of going way outside my comfort zone. And I'm so glad I did it. To be frank, I'm still nervous every night when I have to sing a cappella.
He has to do one of the hardest things ever at any point, even for anyone who does music theater all the time, which is get a note out of the ether and sing a cappella with no support whatsoever and end on a perfect note. It's like, it's an impossible task for anyone.
Beautiful. In fact, Katrina's character asks, is it a prayer or is it a hymn?
The tune seems sad, but are the words sad? What's he saying? Is he praying? And why does it get to me? Is he lonely? Maybe reaching out.
Katrina Lenk singing one of the showstoppers in the new Broadway hit, The Band's Visit. She has another one, The Breathtaking Omar Sharif, in which this Jewish cafe owner sings about her childhood idols, the Egyptian superstars, actor Omar Sharif, and singer and actress Umm Kulthum.
Sunday morning, Umm Kulthum, her voice would fill our lips.
Had you heard Umm Kulthum?
No, I knew who Omar Sharif was. Similarly, would watch movies with my mom of Omar Sharif. You know, Dr. Zhivago was, he was very dreamy. How did I not know who Umm Kulthum was? Now I'm like, what? How did I miss this phenomenon? Aretha Franklin, Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, and Ella Fitzgerald, and Judy Garland all smooshed into one person. And how much meaning she had to the people in that area.
I would imagine you're now sending the audience out every night going to research Umm Kulthum. I mean, most people, most Americans don't know. But that song, I mean, the range of it, the kind of way you have to sing it is almost a speaking. How would you talk about how you approach the song?
A lot of that is just because the song is so soulfully and intelligently written. It starts out small and then kind of gets carried away with itself.
And the music flows.
And it's also great that David, you the director, you see on stage people who talk about having a hard time getting cast in Hollywood because they are Middle Eastern and they're the bad guys usually, or the terrorists. And here they are, many of them actual professional musicians, on stage on Broadway.
Osama Farouk, who's our percussionist, who's brilliant. The most dazzling performance in the show, George Aboud. George Aboud is the fiddler, and there's been a lot of talk about young people. We had one at a talk back the other night who really said, it never occurred to me I would hear that kind of music in a show, that I would see people from my culture just being nice people in a story who are looking for a friend or looking for love or looking to get out of the hole they're in. It's an honor, and it's kind of scary. You know, you think about that when we first start being able to see stories about gay people or anything, where, like any representation, where you're anyone who's treated as the other in a culture. It's, I don't want to say it's important, but it's necessary.
Tony, just your thoughts on how the show's being embraced.
Well, there's definitely, I mean, first of all, just so gratifying to play to full houses. And there's a sort of a quietness, a stillness that we sense from the audience, which is very unlike a Broadway musical audience. At the end, where out of this silence comes this explosion of in their response.
I have heard in the from people afterwards, people that live in Israel or are Jewish or have Hebrew culture in their families, that they're like, oh my God, I'm so glad there's a story about us now, especially because of all the political stuff that's happening even here in the States.
On one stage, there's some hope.
This piece feels like, and people have mentioned this to us, that it is just a respite from all of the noise and nonsense that's occurring out there right now. They feel transported to this little desert town, and they kind of don't want to leave it.
Actors Tony Shalhoub and Katrina Lenk with director David Cromer, their hit musical The Band's Visit. As they say, run, don't walk.
You have access to the entire world of NPR with your smart speaker. Ask it to play NPR or your local NPR station to check the news while you get ready for work or fix dinner. There's a new radio in your house, and it's easier than ever to listen to Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and more. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local NPR station.
In San Francisco, a long-awaited jury trial between two tech giants has finally begun. Yesterday, in opening statements, Waymo, that's the self-driving car unit of Alphabet, Google's parent company, claimed that Uber stole some of Waymo's trade secrets when it hired one of its former executives. Uber calls the accusation baseless. Here to explain is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Teddy Schleifer is senior editor for Recode and joins us now. Hi, Teddy.
How's it going?
It's going well, and this is about Waymo's trade secrets and one of its former executives, Anthony Lewandowski. What exactly is Waymo claiming?
Sure. Well, Waymo's kind of claiming that there's some sort of conspiracy here between Lewandowski, who is a former engineer, and Uber, to take trade secrets from Waymo in self-driving technology and bring them over to Uber, at which point giving Uber or helping to give Uber an advantage in the self-driving tech race. So the company filed a lawsuit after finding that Lewandowski downloaded about 14,000 files right around the same time he left the company. And the question is, were those trade secrets then used to give Uber an early advantage in the self-driving race when Uber later acquired Lewandowski's company?
And Lewandowski is pleading the fifth in this case.
Right.
But another figure at the center of the story is Uber's former CEO, Travis Kalanick. Did Waymo present any evidence to implicate either of them?
Right. Well, because Lewandowski is pleading the fifth, it sort of shifts the focus of attention to Kalanick, who is in a lot of ways a larger-than-life figure here in Silicon Valley. So he's kind of the center of Waymo's suit. They're trying to prove a conspiracy between Kalanick and Lewandowski because Lewandowski is not named as a party in the case because he's pleading the fifth. So the question is, you know, what did Kalanick know and when did he know it? So they're working hard to show that, you know, he was, of course, bringing those trade secrets and was involved in helping Lewandowski give Uber this advantage. A lot of the evidence that Waymo shows kind of revolves around Travis's personality, which is well known here in tech, showing his desire to win at basically any cost in self-driving. So a lot of it is trying to paint a portrait of Travis as someone who would do anything to win, including allegedly stealing trade secrets.
So Uber is denying these claims.
Right.
What's their strategy?
Sure. So they're basically trying to show that Waymo is disgruntled losers, that basically they were behind in self-driving technology and they were losing people like Anthony Lewandowski, who's a talented engineer. So they have a lot of kind of email records where people talk about where Waymo executives are stressed about Lewandowski leaving, where they discuss losing talent to Uber and need to work harder to get better. So Uber's argument essentially is Waymo is losing and that's why they're suing us. And it's, you know, in a lot of ways is about the character of the company as much as it is about the tech.
And what is at stake for both of these companies in this trial?
Sure, it's different things. So Uber, you know, potentially could have to pay millions of dollars and it could be a substantial roadblock in their self-driving tech development if they're found to have basically stolen trade secrets and misappropriated them. Now, Alphabet and Waymo, it's a different situation. For them, this is a pretty unusual move to basically not settle, to go forth with this pretty explosive, well-publicized lawsuit. So the challenge for them is more reputational, right? Like, what happens if Alphabet does this huge suit and, you know, Waymo is basically left looking, you know, successfully by in Uber's case, like a disgruntled loser. So a lot of this is reputational for Alphabet, but it has very, very real possible consequences for Uber if they were to lose.
That's Teddy Schleifer, senior editor for Recode. Teddy, thank you.
Sure thing.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is wrapping up his first tour of Latin America since taking office. He's already met with leaders in Mexico and Argentina. The trip also includes stops in Peru, Colombia, and Jamaica. Joining us now from Miami is Tim Padgett, America's editor with WLRN. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
So how is Tillerson being greeted so far on this trip?
Warily, unfortunately. He began the trip on a bit of a faltering note when he made remarks about what a good thing the Monroe Doctrine still is. As you'll recall, the Monroe Doctrine, it's a 19th century U.S. foreign policy doctrine that said essentially the United States is the boss in the Western Hemisphere. Mm. And that it can do pretty much whatever it wants. And to suggest in the year 2018 that that's still sort of a viable foreign policy doctrine for the United States in this hemisphere does a lot to rankle the feelings of a lot of Latin American capitals and governments and people. And so the trip got off to a little bit of a faltering start as a result of that, especially when you consider that one of the big missions of this trip for Secretary of State Tillerson is to drum up more support for the sanctions regime that right. the United States is trying to take against the socialist regime in Venezuela.
Well, let's talk about that and Venezuela. The U.S. wants other countries to join it in putting sanctions on oil exports from Venezuela in order to apply more pressure on President Nicolas Maduro, who's been accused of undermining democracy in that country. Is Tillerson having any luck getting people to side with the U.S. on this?
Not as much luck as I think he hoped for. And one of the big reasons, again, is because he has had so many stumbling blocks put in place, not just by his own remarks, but by remarks in the past year by President Trump, who, as you might remember, last year suggested that a military option was not out of the question when it right. came to Venezuela. And that just sent alarm bells off across the entire region. It just struck a nerve in terms of the history of U.S. Latin American relations that just didn't help at all the effort on the part of the United States to try to garner more Latin American and international community support for these targeted sanctions that it's making against individual Venezuelan officials to try to create an atmosphere of regime change there.
What about the issue of TPS or temporary protected status? The U.S. has just announced it's ending that status for many immigrants from countries including El Salvador and Nicaragua. And these countries are worried about accepting all these people back from the United States.
No, that's a very good point. Last week, some of my colleagues and I spoke with the Colombian ambassador to the United States. And one of the points he made that he thought was going to be coming up during Tillerson's visit to Colombia was the Colombia-U.S. joint effort to create better security in Central America's Northern Triangle, which, as you know, has a horrific violence problem. El Salvador, in particular, has the highest homicide rate in the world right now. And they're worried that if we end TPS for Salvadorans here and send 200,000 Salvadoran immigrants here back to El Salvador, where they will essentially become recruitment prey for the Maras, the horrifically violent gangs that rule large parts of El Salvador. And it would simply undermine the effort, that joint effort between Colombia and the United States to create a better security atmosphere.
Tim, there are so many issues to talk about, and another one is that the U.S. Is worried that Mexico could be the next victim of Russian meddling in elections. There's an election, presidential election, coming up in Mexico this year, and apparently the Russians would like the leftist, in this case, López Obrador, to win.
Yeah, and that's, I think, one of the big reasons that the U.S. is so concerned about Russian meddling in this election, whereas perhaps the Trump administration wasn't so concerned about Russian meddling, alleged Russian meddling in the United States election in 2016. There is a concern that Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the leftist candidate, as you point out, is somewhat of a left-wing populist, has sort of an authoritarian bent. And they're worried that, you know, he could create a sort of a souring of relations between the United States and Mexico. And so I think that you're right. That is one of the topics that Tillerson brought up with the Mexicans during his visit there last week.
Now, Mexico and the U.S. and Canada are currently in the midst of negotiations to revamp NAFTA. How big of an issue has that been?
A very big one. The Trump administration, one of its boogeymen, if you will, in Latin America, as it sees it, is unfair trade deals in the region for the United States, NAFTA being the most prominent. Before he left for his tour in Latin America last week at the University of Texas, Secretary of State Tillerson said that NAFTA needs to be modernized. And that is something that both officials in both Canada and Mexico really haven't been able to wrap their arms around yet. What does the Trump administration mean when it says modernized? And I think, or they feel that what's going on is that the Trump administration simply is seeing trade deals like NAFTA not so much as bad trade deals, but just good domestic political fodder at home. And I think they feel that NAFTA has worked out very well for all three countries involved. And they're still a little mystified as to why the Trump administration essentially wants to scuttle this accord that's been working for about a quarter of a century now.
That's Tim Padgett, who is America's editor with WLRN in Miami, talking with us about Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's trip to Latin America and the Caribbean. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you have a voice-activated speaker like Amazon Echo or Google Home, you know, it can be handy to ask them to play music or set alarms. But what about states connecting their websites to voice-activated systems to make government information accessible to everyone? Some states are doing it. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Bradley George reports.
Nikhil Deshpande is Georgia's chief digital officer. His team helps state agencies with their technology needs, including websites.
I think it's more around trying to get the information to all citizens, regardless of their abilities or disabilities or their preferences.
About 5 years ago, they started looking at ways to make those sites more accessible for people with disabilities.
So what we decided to do is look at how users, citizens, are approaching GeorgiaGov from an intent perspective. What are they clicking on? What are they searching for? While we were working on that, there was a lot of conversation around communities that are disabled who choose to use voice assistance or digital assistance.
Many people with disabilities use screen readers to read websites. Amazon Echo and similar devices are also catching on, says Venkat Rao. He blogs about assistive technology and has explored ways Echo can be helpful for disabled people.
Usually these like city or state websites are a little convoluted in my experience. So just like asking these questions to a device and getting the response that you're looking for without really like navigating through a website or menu options and things like that. I think that's great.
Alexa, ask GeorgiaGov.
Welcome to GeorgiaGov. Feel free to ask a question.
How do I register to vote?
Voting. Does this sound helpful?
Yes.
To register to vote, either fill out and...
Georgia's Amazon Echo skill is based on the popular topics page at Georgia.gov. It covers everything from voting to gun laws to tax refunds. Developer Rachel Hart says a lot of that information is dense and hard to sort through.
So like we have one that's talking about becoming a nurse or getting your nursing license. And so the blurb at the top is really just explaining what a nurse is, which we realized maybe someone listening to this doesn't really, like, they know what a nurse is at this point. We can cut that out and start to bring up some of those key facts that they're coming for into that top blurb.
No matter what type of nurse you become, you'll need a license first. There are three types of licensed nurses.
Georgia's Alexa skill, or app, is limited. You can hear how to transfer your driver's license or register to vote, but Amazon Echo can't actually help you do those things. Chief Digital Officer Nikhil Deshpande says the state is taking a wait-and-see approach on expanding the service.
This is an MVP, just like a minimum viable product, offering interaction up to a certain point. If we see a good demand for this, I would love to see where the state could gonna go further and, you know, offer some of those experiences as well.
And a lot of that will depend on how willing consumers are to share credit card and social security numbers with their Amazon Echo. If it catches on, Deshpande would also like to expand it to work with other devices like Google Home. Georgia's not alone in offering government information through voice-activated speakers. Utah, Mississippi, and the city of Los Angeles are inviting their residents to ask Alexa. For Here and Now, I'm Bradley George in Atlanta.
So as Congress is facing the Thursday funding deadline, states are looking at another one. Title X funding provides about $250 million federal dollars for family planning services, everything but abortions. In less than 2 months, the grants will expire, and the Trump administration hasn't announced how organizations can get new grants. What's known is that Valerie Huber heads the Title X program now, and she's the founder of a pro-abstinence group. She replaced Teresa Manning, who said on C-SPAN in 2003 that family planning is what occurs between a husband and a wife and God. She is on record as not supporting reproductive services. Susan Wood is a professor of health policy and management at George Washington University. So, Professor Wood, Susan, two people who don't support family planning, the thing the Title X program is supposed to do, are people worried about the funding for this program?
To be honest, yes, they are. And it's not just about funding. Are we going to have enough money for Title X programs? But it's also about what do we mean by providing family planning services? What is actually being provided for women?
Right. And there
people
might be,
are very worried.
That there might be sort of a restructuring or a reconsideration of what the program even does. But what does it do? What is Title X?
Well, Title X started out in the early 1970s as a very bipartisan, even Republican program. It was signed into law by President Nixon. Its chief champion in Congress was then Congressman George H.W. Bush. What it is dedicated dollars that can support family planning services around the country where family comprehensive, confidential family planning services are available primarily to low-income women, but actually to everyone who needs it.
Well, you've told us that the amount of money under this program, Title X, it's smaller than, say, what's covered under Medicaid.
But so
why would it be needed? Does it go to community centers? I mean, are these people who are falling through the cracks somehow? What's it needed for?
It goes in a number of different directions, and different states and communities decide where it goes. So it can go to state health departments, community health centers, and it also goes to the freestanding family planning clinics. But it does a couple of different things. One, it is dedicated funding for these programs, not just a broad primary care or other specialized services. Secondly, it sets a very high standard for quality to make sure that there is comprehensive counseling, that there's a broad spectrum of contraceptive services available, not just one kind or another. And indeed, in those clinics that get Title X funding, they're also getting sometimes reimbursed through private insurance, but also through Medicaid, which is where a lot of low-income women get their family planning services.
No federal dollars are allowed to be used for abortion procedures.
That's correct.
But does any of the Title X money go to Planned Parenthood for the many other things it does, the women's health checkups, the birth control?
Sure. Planned Parenthood, along with many other providers, are sometimes getting Title X grants. But there are very strict rules on keeping the finances separate and the services separate. So currently there's a restriction on using any federal dollars for abortion services, and that includes the Title X dollars.
Look, this delay in any kind of announcement of how the Title X money will be given to states as the deadline approaches, comes as the Trump administration has changed the requirement regarding employer insurance. The administration created a new conscience and religious freedom division of the Department of Health and Human Services. So employers may not just have a religious objection to birth control, but they may have some sort of a conscientious one as well. How do you feel? What's this landscape that you're looking at?
Well, this is the landscape that we mentioned earlier, which is that the entire structure and nature of Title X clinics, health centers, are at risk. And indeed, we have to remember this is based on a particular law and particular regulations that are already in place that require comprehensive services, that require evidence-based information and balanced counseling. So hopefully those things are protecting the nature of what will continue to be the Title X family planning program. But that being said, this administration clearly is hostile to access to contraceptive services and family planning services. So we are, you know, speaking for myself, I am worried that something that actually hurts women could come out. And we have to be vigilant and we have to be prepared to push back, because not only is it what the law requires, it's what women need.
That's Susan Wood, professor of health policy and management at George Washington University, speaking about the funding for the Title X program. Professor Wood, Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
And again, that funding for the Title X program runs out in about 2 months, and the Trump administration has not yet told states and organizations how to apply for new grants. We will follow this story. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.